Michael Kent Jr., welcome to Special Delivery Podcast here at Sportsbet.
Thank you, Simon.
Now known as Michael Kent, though, it's very important for you to stand alone as a trainer in your own right yourself, but I just want to peel it back and introduce you to everybody on Special Delivery Podcast that March this year, you were announced that you would partner up with multiple Group 1 trainer Mick Price as a partnership in training. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Massive opportunity for myself and, to be honest, one that I never saw coming at the start of the year.
Tell me about the meeting, because Mick Price is an eclectic cat, I think. He's a deep thinker. He knows what he wants, and he goes and gets it, and he doesn't mince his words. Well, tell us about the meeting.
Yeah, he's a deep thinker, but he doesn't stuff around, you know. His racing manager, Luke Wilkinson, who is now working for Yulong as their racing manager, told him in February at the Sydney Classic Sale that he was leaving, and Mick gave him his blessings, and literally within 3 days, I only found out after the fact, he gave me a call. He said, "Michael, where are you?" I said, "I'm down in row B here at the sale grounds." He said, "Right, I'll see you in 5 minutes." And he gave me the opportunity to be his training partner, which was a massive one for me. So I quickly called people in my inside circle and went through it all, and had a meeting with Mick a week later, went through all the nitty-gritty, and we shook hands.
What was your connection with Mick Price prior to that?
So I had been working with my dad part-time, who is a trainer in Cranbourne, but also had been doing a bit of bloodstock work, buying and selling horses and managing Phoenix Thoroughbreds Australian bloodstock. So Phoenix, you would know, own Loving Gabby. They're getting big. They've spent close to $200 million the last few years around the world. They've got now 60 racehorses in Australia and 30 broodmares, so they're getting big quickly. And we had Tavi San in training with Mick Price, so they're the white colours with the orange stars.
Yep.
And so I was dealing with Mick a bit like that, and I think I suppose he took some notice of me during that time period. And as I said, that's how his brain works, Mick. He's very good to make a quick decision and not fluff around, and he's asked me, and I'm glad he did.
You were born and bred in the game, so it must have been a big decision for you to accept this role as a partnership with Mick Price. You talked to your family, your father, you mentioned Mick Kent, as a multiple Group 1 winner himself, and your mother, Vicky, is also stems from a racing family, and father, Bobby Scarlett, rode as a jockey. How did that meeting go with the family? Was it easy, or...?
A lot to talk about. Everyone gave me their blessing, including Dad. You know, Mick Price has won 38 Group 1s. You know, he's got a massive business. He probably got the third highest number of horses in training in Victoria at the moment. And on the other hand, Dad, smaller business, probably didn't need me there for the time being. I'm only 29 years old, so... it was a bit of a no-brainer for me to go out with Mick and get that experience. And I'm very thankful that he also gave me the title. You know, I could have just been an assistant to him, but to put me in the partnership is, it's really good of him. It's onwards and upwards from here, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll go back and come back to the setup and the business model of the stable with your 75 boxes at Caulfield and your setup at Warrnambool and obviously pre-training outside of that and spelling. But tell me, you were born and bred in the game. You're well-travelled, though, as a young man in thoroughbred racing because, let's predominantly start with Cranbourne, where your father cut his teeth as a picnic jockey himself. What was it like growing up in a racing family with the dad as a trainer?
Yeah, so literally the whole family's in racing. So, as you said, dad's a trainer. My uncle educates jockeys in Hong Kong at the jockey club there. Mum's side, so mum's dad was a champion apprentice at Caulfield. He was a very good trainer himself. Mum's brother is Robert Scarlett, who was a Group 1 winning jockey, won the Oakley Plate. He now is Anthony Freeman's main track rider, so he rides Shoals, Central Lane, Super Seth daily. I don't ask him for tips. And then I've got an uncle in that family as well, who's a steward with Racing Victoria, and a cousin who is also a steward. So you can imagine what we talk about on Christmas Day. But so it's all there, and Dad did want me to be a vet growing up, so I went to Melbourne University, did a Bachelor of Science in pre-veterinary, but to be honest, just didn't have the passion to be a vet. I wanted to be a horse trainer through and through, but appeased my parents and you know, went through private school in Melbourne University, but was working for David Hayes at Lindsay Park while I was at Fleming at college in Melbourne, and just was at the track every morning and every weekend I could. Then, to answer your question, grew up in Cranbourne. Cranbourne's steeped in racing history, and funny enough, it'll be the future of Mick Price and Michael Kent Racing, because we're moving there next year to train. So it's a funny way it worked out. But Cranbourne's an amazing setup there. Really, it's a purpose-built training facility where there's 1,000 horses training on a training-only complex. Yeah, really looking forward to getting back there. I know it very well.
How is your horse husbandry whilst you were going through school? Were you hands-on learning the stable mechanics and the runnings of a stable, leading horses, washing horses, riding horses, or was it all school first with that direction?
No, it was both at the same time, and I've got my dad to thank for that mostly. He's he's the epitome of a good horseman, my dad. He's very well read. He was a very good rider himself. He won the amateur jockey premiership 3 times as a young kid, as you know, Simon. You know, very good rider, and he, you know, made me learn the hard way. So I was working for him all the way along, doing boxes to begin with, and strapping horses. Then I did the picnic circuit myself, so I rode and even had my license when I was 23 to train, only because I wanted to sort of get away from dad and just do my own thing, and thought I knew better, as every young kid does, you know. But still had his advice along the way. But yeah, I'd go in the mornings and I'd ride 3 of my own that I was training for the picnics before I started work for dad. My grandpa would be doing the boxes and saddling the horses up in between, and we had a lot of fun doing that. So I think I've cut my teeth the right way. I've learnt all the basics. Dad's also big into the science of things, so I've been to see many surgeries, so I understand if a horse has you know, problems with the throat or its knees and needs chips removed. I've been to see surgeries. I've worked with vets at different stables, so I've seen a lot of the different aspects. So I think that's really put me in good stead as a trainer, because you have to be across everything. You know, we got a lot of horses in training, and you need to understand all the little information and intel that gets thrown at you each day, and then process that and then put that back out to your clients. And I'm really thankful to my father, especially, and my family, that they've helped me, you know, get a good grasp of horse training.
And all those little pieces form the jigsaw puzzle in the picture, inevitably, because every horse is an individual and likes to do things a certain way, and the more easier you tap into that, is that the key to training horses? Is that what you learned early doors when you took out your training license, is to tap into that individual horse to get the best out of it?
Absolutely. No doubt you have a general system, so we basically know when a horse is in the paddock to race day, we usually need 3 months to get them fit entirely, and we have a basic process, but you assess your horse each day and you get the information back from the horse. You know, is it tired, is it sore, is it happy, is it eating well, would it like to be moved into a different box. Some horses need training lighter, some horses need more work. So we have a basic program, but yes, certainly that's the most important thing about training, is individualizing their programs.
How much fun was it as a young man to take upon training yourself? Was it nerve-wracking, or did you, when you say you did, you thought you had a great idea, but when it came to the crunch, it was a lot of pressure on you?
Yeah, less pressure at the picnics. So I was virtually training them, riding them, and owning them myself. So yeah, had no one to answer to. But yeah, I had one particular horse who had had 5 starts for Dad. My uncle owned it, and it was 5 duck eggs, so it was a slow horse.
Yep,
that's fair enough to say. Anyway, I got him, and we easily won the maiden, and we won our class one at the Picnics very comfortably. And anyway, had a break, came back the next season, and took me five starts to win a race. So I don't know, I had him way too fat, and it was a really good learning experience for me to, you know, just be a bit tougher on the horse and, you know, stand back and look at him that, okay, there's no rib showing here. I've got a fat horse, and I probably didn't help him as I was riding the horse. I don't think I was a very good jockey. I won 41 races, but I don't think I was a good rider, to be honest.
What elements make you think like that?
Oh, I had the basics, right? Like, I understood tactics, and I'd walked the tracks, which I think was a big advantage at the Picnics. In particular at Yay, there was a golf course on the inside of the track at Yay, and the sprinkler would pop over the fence and hit the first four lanes. Now, I'd walked the track and realised that the inside four was like a slow seven, and the outside ambulance lane was a fast one. Now, it's a huge difference, especially on bad horses. So you'd sort of, at Yay, you get to the top of the hill, and from the 400 metres to the finish post was all downhill. So I'd just sort of take off early, get to the outside fence, and I think I had 13 rides there for seven winners. So I don't know if I necessarily could punch one out as good as the best there, but just understanding those sort of little things that others might not have helped a bit.
You'd have a huge respect with some of the difficulties that jockeys face this day and age then.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I think riding in the Picnics allows me now to understand what they're seeing out there. How we view it on TV is totally different to what it's like actually riding a race. Even though at the Picnics it's not as, they don't race as close or as tight, but it's still the same sort of basics, you know, jump out of the barriers, find a spot, quicken up.
Well, you're a good judge at setting one and having the money on.
Yeah, I thought I was. I just knew if I had one sort of ready to go from a training point of view, and all I had to do was steer it. So, I won 41 races, and I didn't win the premiership. So Dad won three, but I couldn't win one, unfortunately. I ran second. A guy called Adam Bodie, who still rides for Robbie Griffiths, he won it 10 years in a row, and I was in front up until 2 weeks to go, and he got me late, unfortunately.
Yeah. I want to take you back to Singapore, where you spent age 5 to 11 with Singapore when your father trained there. What was it like living in a different country?
Yeah, best country in the world. The government there is so strong. It's a very safe place for young kids to grow up. Mm-hmm. There's no, virtually no criminal activity. So we were very, you know, they'd have a lot of freedom. At night time, we'd just run around and see mates and stay outside. And it wasn't a racing education for me, because you cannot go racing until you're 18 in Singapore.
Yep.
So I was occasionally at track work, but look, I was young, I was mostly at school. Singapore back then was probably thriving a lot more than it is now. So Dad probably got out at a time when it was just beginning to decline, and he went to Macau then to train for 3 years. Macau is a big gambling island. They turn over more money than Las Vegas each night. So it's a huge gambling area, and not a place where Mum thought she wanted to bring her kids up. Plus, she was ready to come home to Australia, so she brought us home, and we started school back here while Dad did three more years in Macau before he returned home.
The direction to study veterinarian at the Melbourne Uni from your father, there must have been a point behind it.
Yeah, he's very learned, and he would read science journals every night, and often knows as much as the vet who walks into his stables. Maybe he wanted cheap vet bills off me when I qualified. But he just wanted me to do that. And even if I was going to train, there are a couple of good trainers overseas, in particular like Dermot Weld and Mark Johnston, who train in the UK and Ireland, who are vets and also went training. So that was his idea for me. I got into it. I think it still has benefit to me today. I understand a lot of the basic science and veterinary principles revolved in horse racing, but I didn't have the passion to be a vet full time.
So when was it, after you finished schooling, that your father thought it'd be best that you go over to Europe, work with some unbelievable trainers and get some new ideas, starting with William Haggis and also Roger Charlton, I read, Richard Hannon Jr., Willie Mullins. Some of these people are outstanding horsemen and dominate over in Europe. What stage of that in your life was it?
Yeah. So I'd just sort of finished the Picnic thing, I suppose, that little phase of my early life. And I realised, you know, the racing in Australia is one thing, but racing in Europe is where it all began. So Newmarket, England is where I landed first with William Haggas, and I was there for a year as his pupil assistant, which is like the junior assistant. You know, he's a great trainer. He's married to Lester Pigott's daughter, Maureen, and he probably be sort of top three, top four trainer in England. So being in Newmarket is an amazing opportunity. Newmarket is where racing as we know it began under rules. About 400 years ago, King Charles II stumbled across Newmarket with his party and decided it'd be a nice place to work his horses. And then they began writing up some rules for racing, and that's where it all sort of started and stemmed from there. So it's steeped in history, and even as you know, on a how should I say it? As extra to learning what I learned off William, you were immersed around John Gosden, Michael Stout, all these trainers,
the province,
and you could see them all working. Yeah. You know, so there's about 70 acres of, you know, manicured gallops in Newmarket for you to use. So you compare it to a tight track like Caulfield or Flemington to train inside of. You know, we race on tight tracks in Australia, but we also train inside of those tight tracks.
Yep.
England is totally different. It's a far smaller country, but there's just, wherever you look, there's grass gallops and poly track gallops, and it's an amazing place. So there was that aspect of it. I could see John Gosden, how he galloped these horses every day, and I was forever taking notes on my iPad. And then there was also the sales aspect. So Tattersall's sales company is based there, and look, they have the best sales there every year. The most amazing bloodstock go through there. And in October each year for the yearling sales, you know, it's like royalty descends upon Newmarket. You get all the sheikhs from around the world, the queens there. You know, and these people would also come through the stable. So, you know, we'd have the queen coming into the stable to have a look at her horses, and she'd be quizzing you on how the horse is feeling. And
passionate people.
Yeah, and like the sheikhs of, you know, the Arab countries, you know, they'd come in, and so a totally different ball game to hear, you know, the wealth over there. But there's very little prize money, so it is the sport of kings over there.
So you obviously had a plan to go there, not just, hey, I'm on a work visa, I'm just going to go over to Europe and shoot the breeze. You're saying you're making notes on your iPad, and was that important to you to document all of these moments in time that you were able to we'll document, if you like, and then remember to come back and tweak in your training?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm like a sponge, you know. Everywhere I went, I'd write down what they were feeding, their basic work program, how they deal with certain issues. So certainly for me going forward, you know, that's I'll call upon those issues, you know. As a trainer, you need to sort of remember past experiences and, okay, that was the problem there. How did he deal with it? Yeah, so I did that William Haggas experience for a year, and then I thought it'd be smart, because I could ride track work. I did a stable hopping tour, I suppose. So I did 2 weeks with Roger Charlton, who probably trains on the most impressive private setup you'll ever see. Richard Hannon Jr., who is you know, a fantastic trainer, gives the owners an experience like no other. Like, you can walk in there at 9 a.m. and pop a bottle of fancy champagne and watch your horse work from a Range Rover, like it's you know, different
Access,
class.
Yeah.
Willie Mullins, who we all know, very famous. You know, he's built a training dynasty literally on a 800-meter circle sand track, and so just to see how he got him so fit with limited facilities was amazing. You know, so all these different guys, Gordon Elliott, who's the sort of the heir to Willie Mullins' throne in iron and the jumps racing scene. Yeah, so, you know, it's just, I mean.
And then Chantilly.
Chanty, I did Chanty as well, which is, France. And Michael Delzong, who trained Dunedin, I was there for a month, so that was really good as well. And Chanty is, it's a lot different than Newmarket. They train on the flat there, not up the hill, but in a forest, and it's just beautiful. Beautiful.
Is there much separation in terms of the difference on how we feed, how we train, how we prepare? Predominantly, we breed and race for sprinters here in Australia. And when the international raiders come for our spring carnival, they seem to dominate mile and a quarter staying races. Why is that?
Yeah, so to answer your first question, we definitely work less, feed more in Australia. So we want more energy, the horse on their toes to be explosive. And in Europe, they feed less and work more. So they're a bit more dour. And hence why you can get horses, you know, they might be dour stayer in Europe, but they get into our program of sprinting twice a week in training and being fed more. They often, like Gay would say, they often grow an inch when they get here, become more powerful, and they develop a turn of foot, which might not have been seen previously. The reason, you know, they've got amazing facilities to train horse stayers there. So these uphill long gallops is lends itself to training stayers. Plus it's the bloodlines, like their bloodlines are so, you know, they're so deep with staying blood. They've got it all over us there. So
those affinities and form lines.
Yeah, plus we focus on sprinting here in Australia.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You met a gentleman by the name of Dermot Farrington when it comes to bloodstock. It's ideal to have a good eye for a horse, especially when you're going and purchasing these horses at horse sales. What did you learn from him?
Dermot is probably the best agent I've worked with. He's Irish, he's very cunning, shrewd, you know, not there just to buy the expensive lot at every sale. He wants to buy the cheapest, best horse. You know, I've done a lot of buying for him, with him, sorry, I should say. And he's probably, he's the guy also got me the job with Phoenix Thoroughbreds. And I suppose that started the roll into Mick Price. So we also train for Phoenix Thoroughbreds now a lot, and I've got a lot of dealings with Dermot daily. But a very, very smart man, you know, he... even just 2 years ago, he bought a showcasing colt at the sales for £50,000, so about 100k Aussie. That horse won its first up by four lengths. He then got Phoenix to buy into that horse before it went to Royal Ascot. It was beaten a nose there, but came out and won a Group 1 in Ireland late in the year, won a Group 1 at Royal Ascot this year. His name is Advertise. So he's now won three Group Ones. You know, his value must be £15 million. You know, so
what does what street cred does that give a bloodstock agent?
Oh, massive. Yeah. So you, there's you got agents that like to go and just buy the top lot all the time and get their name out there doing that. But Dermot's the guy who likes to buy the cheap horse that turns into £30 million. You know, but he's very, very smart. Very smart man.
Defined. Buying a thoroughbred the right way as a bloodstock agent is confirmation, and then you've got a budget in your hand and bang for buck, like Dermot's buying this horse for £50, you're saying, and it ends up at 15 men. That doesn't happen with all horses, by the way, but structure, what are you going there to do?
Yeah, so we don't buy a sound horse, first of all. Like you know, you're buying for a client usually, so you don't want them to get burnt. You don't want them to have a bad experience where the horse breaks down quickly. So
good for the athlete to get to the track.
Yeah, exactly. So when we look at a horse, we want to see it walk well. That's important because if a horse is walking well, generally, biomechanically, everything's in the right spot. If something's not in the right spot and they're a bit upright or they got bad knees, they'll generally walk like a bit of a crab. So if we see a nice walk like a panther, you know, they're generally going to move well when they get onto the racetrack. You know, and then there's a few other things, you know, you look at it. You learn over time. It's an experience thing. But it's all about buying value, you know, and you're buying, you buy for different clients. Some want to buy the expensive filly that, you know, even if she doesn't win a race, she's still got value on the in the breeding barn, you know.
There's an exit clause.
Yep, exactly. And some guys want to buy those colts to try and make it big and make the big bucks.
And what about demeanour with the yearling at a sale? Do you like to go back a third, fourth, fifth time to see how that horse walks up every day or in the morning and then the afternoon and if they're coping?
Absolutely, that's very important. You know, you see a horse with a bad attitude, doesn't want to go and work with the person leading it. You know, it's often the same when you're getting back to your stable a year later.
Right.
You know, he's not wanting to work with you. He might... You know, you look at a horse like Winx, you know, the reason why she's so good is she tries her heart out every time. Doesn't want to be, she wants to be in front of that pack. A lot of horses are happy to be pack runners. They want to, you know, run with the herd or they don't want to try. So you want to find that horse is a bit special, got a bit of presence, thinks that he's better than the rest of them. You know, you got to relate to the wild, you know, the alpha male in the pack would always be out in front protecting the herd. That's the horse you want to buy.
Right.
So, yeah, definitely demeanor. And like, Coolmore are very good at this. When they, you know, they spend a lot of money. When they buy a horse, like, they'll really test it out. Like, if someone's at the sales setting up an umbrella, like, they'll say, go and stand your horse over there. And, right. and they'll see, you know, is it, does it cope with that? Is it brave? You know, most horses would be like, you know. But they're, you know, and those sort of things are really important when you're buying a horse, especially for a bit of money.
They're the one percenters. You've mentioned Winks. Can you train competitiveness into a thoroughbred, even if you might be able to spot it at a yearling sale?
Yeah, you can for sure. Probably the best way to do that in Australia is to not overtrain the horse, keep them willing to run. So we often work them on the bridle and keep them restrained. And that's often a good way to have them, when they get to the race, they're like, let me go, you know, like they really want to attack the line. Like John Size would be very good at that over in Hong Kong. You know, he doesn't go very hard at all.
So always leave something in the tank.
Always leave something in the tank. Whereas if you bottom them out on the track, you know, they get to the races and they think, oh, here we go again. I'm going to get, I'm going to get killed again.
It's the sense I've been hurt. I can't give any more.
Exactly. Whereas if you work them a bit, 85%, they're thinking, gee, I feel great. How easy is this? You know, I can't wait to be going faster.
So you're relying on natural talent on the day to go that next level.
Correct, and that's mostly how Australians train, whereas in Europe, they would be more likely to, you know, give them a good rub up a hill and really test them out on the track, whereas in Australia, we know that they've got gears and they can work up, but we never fully see it on the racetrack, on the training track, sorry. Also, Peter Moody was very big on, you know, if a horse got beat in a gallop by a better horse on Tuesday, the following Tuesday, he'd make sure he worked it with a more inferior horse so he'd have a win. Okay. You know, if horses are...
So you're building confidence.
Building confidence, of course. All those things come into play. And we use all those principles at Mick Price Racing. Generally keep it very simple. Get them fit, keep them sound, but happy, confidence, that's still a very big part of it.
So if you're trying to contain 85% and keep something that's natural raw ability when you let them off the bridle, what's your benchmark when you know a horse can actually go and win a race in the last gallop or a trial?
You sort of get a... I must say it has gotten a lot harder to win a race first start. You know, with trials nowadays, people get very fit. It's a way of... even for trainers that aren't as... good as other trainers, you know, going to a trial, you work out, okay, he's not fit, trial again, and then you sort of, I'm ready to go to the races. So, but we get a pretty good idea. We sort of start pairing them up with better horses each time, and then
like
all of a sudden...
that's won a race, benchmark 64 horse, you've got a maiden that you think can gallop, this horse is a last start winner, it's already won a maiden and a benchmark 64.
Exactly.
And you'll gallop it up against that, and if it does gallop well with that horse...
Exactly. So even though if you go 90%, but if, you know, if you're still, your rider comes back and says, hey, there was still a bit there, I was probably length in front of that horse, well, yeah, you know you've got a smart horse. You know, and then you just lean into the race, you want to make sure everything goes right, you know, you can... you don't want to, again, probably why we don't gallop them to 100% at home is we don't want injuries to occur at home. We want to get to the racetrack and get a good performance out of them.
So with that process, is it becoming easier for you to place horses to win? Is that the key when they kick off their career? When you've galloped them against those better benchmark horses and you know you've got a good one here, do you like to start off slow or do you sometimes aggressively place horses in metropolitan areas?
Yeah, a bit of both. Like you might have a horse that's not city class, but you still think he's going really well to win on his first start if placed correctly at Bairnsdale or Cranbourne. But then on the other hand, you know, you get a nice horse that is really nice and galloping with Saturday class horses and beating them at home. You sort of think, well, we'll kick him off on a Wednesday meeting and he'd be a very good chance. So, so we often don't know ones that. A moral on debut, you know, because there's a lot of factors going into it, a lot of good trainers. Victoria is very, very competitive nowadays. But I remember when Dad first came back to Australia, you know, he was winning with debutantes all the time because he's very good at getting them fit first up. But I reckon as a population, the trainers in Victoria have gotten better at getting them fitter first up. And I think that's to do with now... The bloodstock values have gone up so highly. The yearling sale purchase has gone up. People don't want to waste runs.
Average price, yeah.
Well, they want to race runs for the owner. Like, you know, you've gone and spent $300,000 at the sales. Well, you're probably going to try and have that horse as fit as you can to try and win on debut and give the owner a good experience. And So there's a the
fine balance
up.
Then for you as a trainer that, okay, you paid, let's say, $80,000 for a horse. You're made and you're going to get back $17,000 in prize money, maybe with a bonus attached to it. And then you've got to try and get some bang for buck to keep, because it's a lot of, how much is it, about $5,000 to have a horse in work 1 month?
Yep. So we say about $40,000 for a year, roughly. Okay. Yep. Okay. Yep.
Plus your vets and
yeah.
There's always a few extras.
Yeah, potentially, yeah.
So to place that horse right, to make sure your owner gets a good experience, it must be pretty difficult with certain horses.
It is, yeah. And there's a lot of different expectations from owners. You know, some are happy to, you know, lose their money and just have a fun experience, and they're happy to go around and, you know, Saturday country meetings, and then others, like we train for a lot of big owners like Phoenix, Aquas, Yulong. Well, if they're not city class, they're out the door. You know, they don't need them. They're not mums and dads that want to be watching their horse on a Cranbourne Sunday. They want to go to the big stuff. So there's a lot of different.
So how difficult is it to deal with personalities of owners? Because they all come from different walks of life. They've all got their own businesses, but their passion and their outlet is to own a thoroughbred horse. Is that difficult?
Yeah, it's very complex. But I think Mick Price is so good at it. Like, he's well known in the game for being transparent and frank, and that's why he gets repeat business. How you see him on TV or radio being open about his horse's chances is exactly how he is to his owners. So I regularly get feedback that we're the best communicators in the state with our owners, and that's a big part of my job, is giving updates once a week on the horses. Mm-hmm. But we don't give BS. We just tell it how it is. If the horse is training well, it's training well. If it's had an average week, we'll tell them. And if it's not good enough, we'll be the first to tell them that's not good enough. And, you know, they might be better off reinvesting their money in another horse next year.
And we know you're big supporters of the BS campaign here at Sportsbet too. And we have paired up with you in terms of our relationship with Sportsbet too. We support Mick Price's stable, and we ask that anybody that's looking to get into horse ownership to get out and visit Michael and also Mick Price, because it's exactly what you get, honesty, and that's what you want when you're paying the bills, because we talk about that circle in racing, whatever goes around comes around in a way. You mightn't like it when you first hear that your horse is no good, and then you try and, how many owners take their horses somewhere else, 6 months later they've spent another $30,000 in the drain and the horse is still in the same spot.
Yep, that's right. And what's better, like that or paying up for 12 more months and the horse getting no result and you're still in the same spot 12 months later without $40,000 in your bank? So, plus I think Mick's a good judge, you know, he's a smart trainer. So you're not getting bad advice that the horse is no good and he might have missed it. He doesn't miss them. Like you know, he's very fair on them, gets them fit, sound. Okay, if they're no good, okay, then it's time to go.
So what are the unconditionals? Mick Price's training methods, what are two or three or four unconditionals that you've learnt underneath Mick when you go into the stable, his business model, his training model?
Well, one of them, I think it differs slightly from my father, is the owner comes first. So if the owner wants something, we'll give it to them. Like if they want to go to that race, mm-hmm. we're very much, you know, they pay the bills. So we're very much about the owner. But Mick's training is very simple. You know, we get them all pre-trained before they come to us. So they do 4 weeks. So basically 3 months of a training program from paddock to race. The first month is just slow jogging. Now, to save the owner's money, we always do that at one of our, we got three or four pre-trainers.
Yep.
Then they come into the stable sort of week five, and they basically just build up with some galloping work twice a week. Then you get to about week nine, so the third month, and that's when we do two trials or two jump outs, one or two more gallops, and then race. So that's
okay.
Very simple, but it's just very simple training. There's no BS.
How close do you have to work with vets and farriers?
Mick's very low on vet fees.
Yep.
You know, I often say, oh, you know, should we have a look at that? He said, Michael, don't want to cost Zora any money on vets. Leave it. But we got very sound horses. Yeah, Crawford's got a great facility there, the poly track, the sand, the grass tracks. We've always got grass. So we've got very sound horses, I must say. Yeah, so vet fees are low.
Okay, what about some of your fresh ideas as a young man coming in? Does Mick ever sit you down and say, okay, we've got certain circumstances with horses here. You've seen them track work this morning. Tell me what you think, Michael.
Yep, all the time. I'm a second set of eyes. You know, we've got a, you know, we train 200 horses. We've got a Warrnambool base, so I get down there as well to keep an eye on that. We're forever at horse sales, so I'm a big component of buying horses, which is probably the most important thing in the stable. Mm. You know, if, you know, Chris Waller's an amazing trainer, but if Winx ends up in any trainer's stable, she's a champion, right? So if we can find those elite horses, that's a big part of it. You know, you can't make a V4 into a good horse. You need to buy the V8s and the and the better. So, but yeah, I didn't come in and try and change what Mick does. Mick's been mega successful in the top five for the last 15 years in Victoria. So I've got my ideas, a few fresh ideas here and there, and he takes them on board. But in general, I'm just there to compliment him.
Well, Mick mentioned that you're an absolute horse person with great credibility coming from a racing family. You're very well educated and he's given you the opportunity. I read with interest that Aidan O'Brien, before he turned 30, you got the gig when you were 28. James Cummings, now who's dominating for Team Golfin, got the opportunity before he turned 30 to settle down with wives and building a family. I think one of the questions to Aidan was that you need to settle down, young man, because he was a bit of a young lad that would get around. Yourself, you settled down with Tian?
Yeah, Tian's a lovely girl. She's a very good show jumper who works part-time in racing and is also studying to be a teacher at Monash University. So she's been with her for 16 months now. She rides for Robbie Griffiths in the mornings at track work. And then also helps out the Cranbourne Turf Club on race days. But yeah, I think it's great. I've found her. She's you know, really good. I think it's important for anyone in racing to find a partner in racing, because the hours we work, we're up at 4 a.m. and you know, you nap at irregular times. So she gets it, I suppose. I think it'd be difficult if you were dating someone that was going to bed at midnight and waking up at 8 a.m. You know, you wouldn't see them.
Yeah. And what about time away from racing? Obviously, it was interesting talking to you prior to us filming this, that prior to working for Mick Price and getting the opportunity, you'd normally have a nap throughout the day, but Mick starts a little bit later. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so a lot of stables, obviously the stable itself, we work in the morning, the horses have a rest during the lunchtime, so we finish at 10 and then we come back at 2 and then we work through it all about 4 o'clock, so they have the afternoon shift and the morning shift. And it's very difficult on staff in the racing game, because that split shift doesn't allow much time during the day, but it takes up your whole day, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
So with my dad, that's how I used to do it. I have a nap at lunchtime, but you wake up groggy and, you know, it takes you a while to wake up again. I far prefer Mick's program. So we get there at 5, so I'm up at 4, start work at 5, finish the morning track work at 9, and then we're in the office until like 2 or 3 o'clock. So I get everything done, very efficient. And then once I leave that office, boom, I can switch off. And I think it's so important. And Mick's very good at it. You know, I get Sunday afternoons off. And I think it's so important. Racing can really, you know, drag you down. And just, there's racing every day and every night. And if you wanted to, you could just, you know, go to all those meetings. But it's, you know, you need to be fresh to think properly the next day. So getting home at 3 or 4 o'clock, I can just switch off, go to the gym, have a swim. You know, walk the dog, just be normal, you know, be normal, and you know, not trying to answer the phone too much after 5 o'clock to owners, so they understand. And yeah, I think it's very important.
Twitter handle Michael Reece Kent. Twitter, social platforms this day and age, Facebook, and is it really important for stables to be more proactive this day and age?
I think it is. I think it is. Yeah, Mick Price has got 17,000 followers, which is pretty massive. So, you know, if we tweet something out about, you know, a good story we have, or even if a horse we're trying to sell, like, it's amazing the reach you get. So, yeah, we like to tweet out, you know, our positive results from the stable, and it's amazing people, like, you know, don't actually look at the premiership, just see what you wrote on Twitter and come by and say, gee, you guys are going really well, and it's great. So we want to get that message out there that we're doing well, we're getting good results, and definitely Twitter is a big part of that.
Tell me, Stable Stars, we're middle of October, we're filming this, the future for Price and Kent. You got a lot of young horses, not so much older horses, wait for age, staying types. Tell us about some of your Stable Stars.
Correct, yeah. So unusually, Mick Price has normally got three or four Group 1 wait for age horses. He has none at the moment.
Yep.
It was funny, the first month I started before I was on the license, I thought, how good is this? It was the month of March. He had 7 stakes winners in 4 weeks. I thought, geez, this is too good to be true. And then we've only had one since. But that's happened in stables. You know, stables go into form and out of form. And I think that's because of, you get a crop of good horses coming through. Well, if they're all Saturday grade or better, well, they're going to win their maiden. They're going to win their 64. They're going to go through the grades. We've got that nice young bunch now, which we haven't had for the last 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. Stable Stars going forward, we've got a lot of nice two-year-olds. We've got one debuting at Moonee Valley this Saturday in the English Banner called River Twain.
Yep.
He galloped this morning at the Valley with Ollie on board. Ollie's really keen to ride the horse. He trialled really well last week at Caulfield. He galloped well this morning with one of Kieran Mars. He's a beautiful colt by Headwater. I think he'll go well. We've got a nice filly. We've got a really nice filly, actually, who is owned by Yulong. She's a brazen bow filly who costs $400,000. Her name is Waiting for the Day.
Right.
She was at Caulfield. She was jumping out really well. She's probably, I think, our fastest two-year-old at this stage. Just didn't like the barriers after a couple of times in there. So she was putting the heels in the ground and not wanting to go in. So we sent her down to Pete Dalziel at Cranbourne, who's a guru with these barrier horses.
Yep.
Only 2 weeks, barrier blanket on, and had a trial at Cranbourne yesterday, the jump out. Mm. In trial two, she won by 3 lengths. Brian Higgins rode and said she's a jet. So we really like her. We're going to debut her on Melbourne Cup Day in a Group 3 down the straight.
Yep.
She's a very, very nice filly. Of our three-year-olds, there's a filly called Frondua. Frondua won on debut by 4 lengths at Maui. She's a horse we bought out of the trials in New Zealand, which we like doing. We find these horses that have won trials. They might have a pedigree, but they're great types and they can gallop and you can buy them cheap. Like, we bought her for about $120,000, I think.
Right.
6 weeks later, the owners are having a winner by 4 lengths on debut. So she's one that, to go back to what you were saying earlier, that we thought would just win on debut because she was showing group class ability and we're taking her to Mowing on a Saturday. So we were very confident she'd win, and Julie saluted for the owners. But she's a horse we'll be targeting potentially at Group 1s in the autumn. She's just come back into work. We've got a horse this Saturday called Craftsmanship, who's a nice three-year-old. He won a stakes race last night in Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
Runs in the Vase with Hugh Bowman on board. He worked very well this morning. I don't think the Vase is an overly strong race this year for a Group 2. I think if you follow a couple of those younger horses anyway, they're worth taking notes down on.
Outstanding. Are you a punter? Do you like having a bet?
I do. I don't back 5 horses a day. I'll back 5 horses a month. So I just wait for ones that I've seen. It might not just necessarily be our stable, but you see things when you're watching races every day that you thought, oh, that was a good run and that's a really nice horse. And if I see a quality, I love to back quality horses. I don't want to be backing a weak horse in a weak race that needs everything to go right. I want to be backing a Saturday grade horse that's well down in its company in a maiden, for example, that, if things do go wrong in the run, it can still win. So, I'm not a big punter, but I like to do it occasionally.
Who do you look up to in the training ranks?
Mick Price, Mick Kent, and...
good answers.
Yeah, I think definitely Chris Waller. What he's done is nothing short of amazing. He's all about system and processes. He's fastidious. You won't find a trainer who's more dedicated than him, and then over in England, John Gosden, for sure. He just had that X factor about him,
Yep.
Winning Group 1s. you know, you even look at the results this
year. He's enabled trainer. He's done a fantastic job with her.
You know, amazing. So gets it right on the big days. And I think that's important for a trainer is nailing your grand final, you know.
What's the best thing about training thoroughbred horses at 29 years of age, Michael?
Oh, it's the thrill of it. You know, whether you're a trainer or an owner, you cannot replicate that thrill of a winner, I think, unless you're an elite athlete. I think, you know, jumping up and down the grandstand at Flemington as your horse crosses the post, you know, you ask any owner, they don't get that feeling anywhere else and they can't buy that feeling, you know. So getting into a racehorse is what it's all about. And hence, when they get that feeling, it's addictive. And I'm the same. It's the winning feeling, but it's the journey you go along to get there, you know. A jockey might know the horse for 2 minutes, but we know the horse for 3 years. And you see all the little things that go wrong on the way, and you plan out a program and you set it for a race and it comes off. You know, it's amazing. Racing's full mostly of disappointments, but the highs are very high, and that's what keeps us going.
Well, it's been a candid chat. It's been a great chat. You're a young man. You're the future of our sport. I've known you since you were that big. Rode for your father. Rode a lot of winners for Dad. I want you to say hello to Mum for me, Vic.
I will.
But we always finish with 60 seconds with Simo. So I'm going to ask you 60 seconds worth of questions. If you can fire out your questions. You see these Friday nights at Moonee Valley?
Yep.
When we interview the jocks? Okay. What is your claim to fame?
Riding a winner and training winner on the same day on different programs.
Are you a morning or a afternoon person?
Morning.
What quirks do you have?
Constantly walk the room and I'm on the phone.
What's your favourite drink?
Scotch and Coke.
What do you hope never changes?
I hope that racing stays strong.
What songs do you have in your car when you get a bit of time to yourself?
A podcast of SD Marshall.
Good answer. How would you rate yourself out of 10 as a person?
A solid 8.
What are you absolutely determined to do?
Train Group 1 winners.
What skill would you like to master?
I'll pass, I don't know.
What website do you most often visit?
Probably punters.com.
Who do you look up to most in life?
My dad.
When was the last time you were nervous?
Right now.
What's the best part about being in a relationship?
Bedroom.
What's your favourite TV show?
Favourite TV show is... I don't watch a lot of TV. Netflix, probably.
What fad or fave, if you like, would you hope to come back?
Say it again, sorry?
What past fad or trend would you hope that would come back?
Tie-dye T-shirts.
And give us a quote that you live by, Michael Kent.
I don't know, actually.
You don't have a quote? Yeah. Well.
Just do it.
Just get out there and work hard. And do it?
Yeah.
All right. The old man didn't have one that he just continued to...
He had a good one. He said, two rules in my stable. Rule number one, I'm the boss and I'm always right. Rule number two, when in doubt, refer to rule number one.
We always finish with a hug, mate. Thanks for coming in.
Right here.
Good to see you, Michael.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Good on you, mate.
Cheers.